Today's TES podcast is sponsored by Thrive. Thrive was established 25 years ago to provide the tools, skills, and insights needed to help children to become more emotionally resilient. Working with almost 3,000 schools, the Thrive approach is a method of identifying gaps in children's emotional and social development and providing training so that the adults around them can help them to progress and engage with education and with life.
Hello and welcome to this TES podcast. Today we'll be discussing the fight, flight, freeze response and what happens when this reaction is overactive and triggered within a classroom setting, translating into behavioural response such as a student seeking to leave the classroom. Joining me today to discuss what teachers can do to be more prepared in this situation and practical strategies they can employ to manage it are Ginny Bootman. Ginny is a former head teacher with over 25 years of teaching experience. She's currently a Special Educational Needs and Disabilities Coordinator of two primary schools in Northamptonshire. She has a particular interest in the role empathy plays with regard to the building of positive relationships in school settings and writes regularly about this topic. And Sharon Gray. Sharon has 21 years experience as a head teacher over three different settings, including a special school in South East London where she supported children who had been excluded from mainstream settings due to mental health difficulties. She is a trainer of the Thrive approach and is currently supporting a number of education settings and local authorities with their reconnection to resilience approach as schools begin to open more widely. Sharon is an independent consultant for Wholehearted Learning and a member of the Youth Justice Board. Now, fight or flight is something we all recognise from our own experiences and can remember a time when we felt stressed and experienced these emotions. But there is a scientific reason behind why we feel like this, isn't there? Sharon, would you mind telling us a bit more about the theory behind the flight response, please?
Yes, of course. So in terms of fight or flight, when we experience a stimulus that triggers our bodies, we physiologically go through a series of changes that result in us autonomically moving quickly out of the way to get out of a situation that's perceived as dangerous. So it might be, for example, you step into the road and you see a car is coming down at some kind of speed. And without you even thinking about it, your body takes itself out of the way, jumping out of the way. And the key is that at this point, the body takes over. As humans, we're not in our thinking brains in this moment. It's that autonomic, automatic, physiological response. Not in our thinking brains, and certainly not in our sort of social engagement brains. More often than not, can't even hear the people around us. We are in a survival, automatic, autonomic system. And this is what's almost kept us alive for all of these years. It's within our sort of earliest evolved systems. However, of course, it can cause significant difficulties within the classroom, because where we have children, and not just children, but potentially adults, that can be quickly triggered into this fight, flight and freeze response, the fight, flight response being that automatic, autonomic, we call it discharge behaviours, then they can potentially find it almost impossible to engage with their learning, engage with each other, connect with each other. And these children and potentially adults can come across as really quite hyper-aroused, hyper-alert, and so not ready to access learning in the classroom.
So why might we see this type of exaggerated stress response in children? Are there any examples you can give of what might trigger this response whereby a student seeks to flee the classroom, for example?
So that the physiological response, I can give an example. So sadly, when I was about 7 years old, my mum was called into school to talk to the teacher because I had pushed a whole tray of oranges out of the hands of the teacher. And I was quite a quiet child and no one really understood why my behaviour had been so outrageous. And we didn't really understand and we couldn't find the trigger. And so it was felt that it was a chosen behaviour. But about 5-6 years ago, I was reflecting on this with my mum. And my mum then mentioned to me that when I was about 6-7 months old, I was sat in the garden with her and I was sucking on a bit of an orange. And at that time, I was stung by a wasp on my lip. Now, you can imagine the sense of sort of a potential threat for me with that as a baby. I cannot remember that situation that was particularly pretty much traumatic. And this is what happens in life. These kind of things happen without judgment of my mum being a bad parent. It just happened. She was devastated. I can't remember it. But my trauma isn't in the event itself. It's in the body, and the body holds that. So reflecting back, when I smelt those oranges, my body physiologically went into that survival mechanism and so responded in a way to endeavor to keep me safe. But of course, we weren't aware of that trigger then. So it's almost the fight and flight response happens automatically, instantaneously sending neurochemicals surging through our bodies, priming for the fight, flight, discharge response. And again, it's what's enabled us to survive. So we might not really know the trigger for some of these potential discharge type behaviors, because it's almost within our sensory system. And we pick this up through the senses, knowing also that that communication is 80% to our body language. So, do you know, have you ever been into a room and it's silent? But you kind of know something's happened. There's been a problem. And that's our neuroception. And it happens beneath our subconsciousness. So we pick up that there's a potential threat and respond instantaneously in the moment. And this is where we need to think quite carefully about looking through a slightly different lens when we're looking at behavior and responses from our children. And even as importantly, if not even more importantly, how our adults respond, because quite often our adults can be triggered by some of the behaviours of the children and almost respond in a counter-aggressive way that further exacerbates or triggers the behaviours from the children.
So it isn't necessarily a major event that could trigger this response. It could be just, as you said from your experience, seeing the tray of oranges. And for another child, it could be sitting in a different place or perhaps losing something. Does this align with your experience of it in the classroom too, Ginny?
Absolutely. And I completely agree about this trigger. And the trigger can very much be to do with an action that they see, a smell, as Sharon said. It might be a perfume. A lot of the work that I do is concerned with attachment issues and children who have been through trauma. And they are, as Sharon says, they are hypervigilant. Mm. It might be a sound. And it might be a quiet sound. Cool. These things are not what others would perceive to be very noisy or big things, but I think something like a perfume that could be connected to a previous experience, or Sharon said, the smell of an orange, we just have to always be aware that many, many different things can trigger children, and we may never know what those triggers are.
And I can imagine, given how many different things it could be that trigger a child, and how unknown they are to teachers, that sometimes a student going to leave the classroom having this fight response might be interpreted as misbehaviour. Is that a common problem, do you think?
I think we need to, as schools, we need to have a team approach. We need to have our radars on so that we are looking for ways to help children stay in the classroom. Exactly as you said before, Chloe, where are they sitting? A trigger can be where a child sits in the classroom. So they may need to be nearer the door so that they can see everybody who comes in and goes out of that room because of something that has happened previously in their life. So we need to make our teams completely aware, have our radars on. So I constantly have a radar on just to see what is happening in the classroom so that I can preempt, if I can, if things are changing in the classroom, that I can help the children think about the day ahead and also have that really, really strong positive relationship with the home, because nobody knows their children better than the parents. So actually, And if something does happen, we talk it through with the parents. So rather than children leaving the classroom, if at all possible, we change the environment for them. I've had so many different things. I've had tents up for children so that they have their space within the classroom. I've had tents up with, ball pits that young children go into so that the child can get in there and have that sensory feeling that they need. I've had doors open so that children can go outside. So it's a case of managing what the children need and then being able to have a safe place. That might be an enclosed place for them, or it might be that they do go out, but it's planned and we timetable it in. So yes, children can leave the classroom, but in my experience, it's better if we can have that planned and timetabled in to help them with their sensory issues or their perceived needs. But training and explaining is pivotal to everybody within the classroom context and within the school context.
And Sharon, do you find that's a common problem, that actually sometimes teachers can view this behaviour when a student tries to leave the classroom as being provocative or as misbehaviour?
I think I've always found it really useful to unpick it beyond that. And certainly through the Thrive approach and the training through Thrive, we're supporting our adults and across our school systems to almost come from a place of self-awareness themselves, as opposed to unconscious self-defense. And so how do we, from the outset, facilitate a sense of safety in the classroom where the child feels that they belong, feels that they are special, that their needs can be anticipated and met. And again, that real crucial part, that sense of safety, because some of those triggers can be a roll of the eyes from the teacher. The pitch, the prosody of voice as Ginny comes back into the classroom, oh, great to see you again, that potential trigger. So coming from a place of being aware of where we are as the adults, knowing the children really well so that you can preempt and meet needs. And then, as Ginny was saying, rehearse, have spaces, places and people of real safety that the children are aware of. And so, and then rehearse when times are calmer and more regulated, sort of practice going to those places or what we're going to do. And I think that's really, really crucial. Quite often, when we see those discharge behaviours, adrenaline and cortisol is surging through our muscles, and cortisol is a muscle mobiliser. So we need to get going. And actually, that can support in the dissipation of that cortisol. And particularly when there is an understanding adult leaning in with curiosity, empathy with authority, that too is incredibly supportive. That it's almost, there is no more effective neurobiological intervention than a safe relationship. The relationship works to bring the brain and body back to regulation. And that's a quote from Bruce Perry. But the potential for the adults in the first place to develop and facilitate a sense of safety. And like Jenny, part of that has been in my practice for the children to work with the adults to create little tented off areas, spaces, material over a table that they can crawl. Where do animals go when they feel that they're at risk or at threat? They tend to go to quiet, dark spaces. So getting children to create these for themselves, because of course we need to keep them safe, we need to know where they are, can be really, really helpful. And then giving them the permission, the support, repeated sort of experience of practicing how we use them.
Okay, so if a teacher is informed about how trauma can impact a child and understands that often this behaviour is a communication of an unmet need, then we're hoping that when they see a child responding in a way which is related to current or past experience of trauma, rather than a child behaving badly, they recognise it's a child who needs our help. So going back to what you were saying earlier about creating the space for students, what practical strategies are there to help manage this behaviour and meet the child's emotional needs so that they can regain their emotional equilibrium and hopefully re-engage with learning?
I find it's very much about finding what works for the child. So in my experience, one of the best things that we've had are sensory boxes. So this is a variety of equipment that we have in a box, and then the child chooses what they want in their sensory box for that day. And I think that is really, really important. that the child has ownership. So we have resistance bands of different resistance. We have resistant putties. Children can choose different resistance bands according to how they feel that day. We have so many different items in the sensory box. They take them out. They have them in their safe place in the classroom. And I have to say, it's really interesting because these safe places, they move into and out of as well as they, as depending how they feel on that day. We have things like little magnetic toys that they can join together. We have little plastic people. So some are fine motor, some are resistant. Some children need that resistance. And it might be that an adult works with the child initially to model how to use it. And then after that, they have ownership of it. We have, it's just a whole learning curve. So the latest one I've got is ribbons. The satiny feel of a ribbon. And I buy loads of ribbon, all in the same colour, cut it into 10 centimetre lengths, give it to a child. If they lose it, doesn't matter, they get another ribbon. But it's really very much finding out what the children like. Sometimes we have paintbrushes they put on their hands. Sometimes it's feathers. So it's very, very much unpicking by working with that child to find what works for them. And they do work. But I think the most important thing is this sense of ownership. Mm-hmm. And nothing is right and nothing is wrong. Children sometimes find their own sensory toys. We go with it. You know, it's about working together, about having ownership, about being positive with the child and working with them and exploring those sensory toys with them and them seeing that they are valued for what they are. The other thing is, I let the children in my class, any child, use any of the sensory toys. So they can go, I have shelves with see-through plastic goldfish bowls and it's like a little sweetie shop. You can go, anybody goes and gets what they like. And I think that's really important. This is the norm, what we're doing. It's not something different. It's not something unusual. It's just part of our classroom routine.
So for you, it's more about empowering the child and kind of preempting that they might have this response to flee the classroom and ensuring they have something to help them control that response.
Yes, and things don't have to cost money. My children carry big containers of paint and they'll walk around and they'll choose the weight of the paint container. They've got lovely handles. I think I'll have this one today. They go for a little walk, come back, and they are realigned. And it costs nothing, which I think is brilliant as well.
And Sharon, what strategies do you suggest when you go into schools?
I think, again, it comes from the understanding of the neuroscience research, knowing that education requires state regulation. And so how we can, as a matter of the normal routine of the day, welcome our youngsters in from the outset so that they feel, as Ginny said, empowered, but that they belong, that they're wanted here. And then there's some fabulous, again, free resources such as Go Noodle, for example, that really takes children through sort of regulatory type opportunities, sort of either sort of hyper sort of arousing children who are a little bit flat or just calming down the stress regulation system. And so doing that kind of thing, you know, when children first come into the classroom, maybe having a bit of drink of water, a little bit of chat, welcome, that type of thing, where one may feel that that's a waste of time. Actually, by giving the time to regulate the children and the adults together, we maximise the learning time together. And I think that's absolutely crucial. And I think the other thing is the how the stance of the adult. You know, I know when I was starting in teaching, when I got a little bit anxious myself, my voice would go up like this and I would start to shout at the children and tell them to be quiet. And actually, they would all start to get really hyper-vigilant as well. That's not helpful. What is helpful is being aware. We're not saying that our teachers always have to be absolutely calm, because that's not, we're human beings. noticing and coming from a place of self-awareness as opposed to that unconscious, subconscious self-defense. And sometimes, you know, we'll talk with teachers and adults in school settings and say, actually, maybe we're not the best person to support this child in this moment because we're dysregulated. It doesn't mean that we're awful or bad. It just means we're looking after the child, the best interests of the child. And so it might be Ginny comes in to support when I'm talking with Charlie because I need to just go and have a walk myself as the adult. And having systems across a school setting can be really helpful. Also, in situations of potential crisis, it's quite likely we may as well, as the adults, be slightly triggered. So having scripts can be really helpful as well. Because when adults are triggered, we're not in our thinking brains either. We're not in our social engagement. Mm. We potentially are coming from that autonomic, automatic response. So we need to be really careful at that time. Again, we don't exacerbate the situation. So certainly in many of the settings that I work, we have scripts for those moments. And so we're rehearsing as the adults again and again and again. And so we can be kind of clear in our communication. Don't know about you, but if you ever sort of, I don't know, you've got to a situation like the airport, you've forgotten your passport and you're with your best friend and suddenly you say the most outrageous things in the moment. Because you kind of lost it. It's an automatic, autonomic response. But actually, you know, as adults, we need to kind of be aware of that as much as possible. So whilst we're reducing risks in classroom, we're also creating and giving out cues of safety all the time through the subtlety of our body language, as I said previously, the pitch, prosody of voice, and being aware of our non-verbal communication. Because our hypervigilant children will be very, very much aware of it.
And that must be so challenging for a teacher, given how much they're all juggling at the moment and the immense pressure they're under. What advice can you give teachers who are juggling these myriad demands and who may find themselves in a situation where they're completely overwhelmed and perhaps feel things are spiraling out of control?
I think that's really interesting. And over this, through the pandemic, I think it's really shone the lens. I've been doing some work with Professor Barry Carpenter. He initiated the recovery curriculum, and I'm working now with him on the kind of reconnection to resilience. And so it's looking at how we can reconnect with these children. And we know that many of our children through the pandemic will have gone through significant change. Change is tricky for anybody to manage. Some children will have loved being at home and then they'll start coming back into school. Some children will have been in school in bubbles of three children that are now extending to 8 and potentially 30. So we're all going through change, as are the adults. So if we know that and know that change in itself can be challenging, let's preempt and prevent by anticipating that some of our adults and some of our children may feel stressed and be easily triggered. So thinking about how we can support our staff to be settled and prepare to relationally welcome children back in, and the leaders managing and protecting, sort of almost creating, you know, really brave leaders creating courageous cultures where we're giving the space for reconnect. And so we're not putting the pressure on our teachers to do baseline assessments. So the second day back, we get into half an hour of maths and half an hour of language. Again, we will not be wasting time by enabling our educational staff to give space and time to reconnect with the relationship, to develop relationships. Indeed, I think that's the only way that we will really be able to support our children and their re-engagement, both in the short term and in the long term. So for me, it really is about leadership and leaders coming from that place of self-awareness. We've seen some of our most senior leaders quite often coming from a place of self-defense, unconsciously, subconsciously. Mm. Let's not do that in schools. As a leadership team, we need to facilitate the sense of safety for our adults, look after our adults, almost put them first, support their emotional well-being so that they can do that for the children and the families. The families are the experts of their children. And so working together to do that will be absolutely crucial. So for me, as a leader, it starts with the staff team, the entire staff team, how we reconnect, how we take away those pressures, sitting with the courage of vulnerability almost, to do the right thing for the children, which is all about settling back into that regulated state. So in time, and if we get it right, it won't necessarily take a huge amount of time. It's just putting the focus on getting it right from the outset to support those children re-engaging over time. Because as we know, a dysregulated child is not a learning child. They are an anxious child, does not learn well.
And Ginny, what are your thoughts on that? What advice can you give teachers if they feel things spiralling out of control as a student tries to leave the classroom?
Yeah, I think this idea of actually stop, think again, and then respond, so that we're not in the fight or flight situation. I also think from teachers' point of views, we need to be honest. We need to go into the staff room and say, actually, I'm having a really difficult time. Yeah. Can someone help me? Has someone got any guidance or support for me? Because we need to be there to support each other. And I think the best way to support one another is to be honest. And I think the role of empathy in all of this is so important, that we can all empathize with one another about what we're all going through. Mm. And actually, we've all been through different things with the pandemic. And when we go back into school, our colleagues are still going through different situations, whether it be at school or at home. So I think it is a case of connecting with our colleagues again, because actually we haven't, you know, actually been, you know, all of us together in school for such a long time. So I think it's getting that connection with our colleagues and saying, actually, I'll be there for you, I'm there for you, or actually, here's a cup of tea, you look like you're having a bit of a tricky time today, what can I do to help? It is actually as simple as that. I think that we are just saying, we're here for you, we genuinely are here. Are you all right? You say it once, don't you, Sharon? Then you say it again. Because sometimes we hold back because we don't want to bother people. So it really is to do with the honesty and giving ourselves time and saying, do you know what? I'm finding this difficult. Can somebody help me?
And Ginny, that's so true. It reminds me, it's that sometimes we think that the children are choosing these behaviours, that they're almost manipulative. But in actual fact, in that moment, actually, they are having a hard time, not intentionally giving a hard time. So if we can have, like Ginny has just described with adults leaning in with each other with empathy, curiosity as to what sits behind the behaviour, we can start to look at the emotions beneath and the needs, and we can start to attend to those needs and those emotions. And over time, the behaviours will change. So this isn't that we're complying with poor behaviour. Absolutely not. We're creating the conditions to change those almost non-problem-solving behaviours through repeated experiences. Now, our brains almost rewire as a result of experiences and relationships. So we want to almost support our children in rewiring the brains to then almost as a matter of deferred behaviour to go back to a different way of responding. So, for example, when I pushed that tray of oranges out of the way, at that time, we focused on the naughty behaviour of me pushing the oranges out of the way. And I remember being told I had to sit in the classroom by myself. I didn't have a clue what was going on. I was just in this absolute space of just, difficulty. We never kind of looked at what the potential trigger was. Over time, we began to realise I didn't like oranges, and so we didn't have them. And now I've developed a sort of system that I can regulate myself when I smell an orange. And I can say, actually, it's just what's happening to my body. I am safe. It's absolutely fine. And so the first thing to do is co-regulate with the child, calm their body system down. And sometimes that's saying nothing. That's just sitting alongside with empathy. Wow, I'm really wondering what's going on for you right now. And we might get it wrong. We might get it right, but we're starting to support the child to regulate themselves and finding ways that they can show and share with us the issues, so that we can then start to find a way to explore these issues and work with the stress regulation system. So we almost put the behaviour to one side, mm-hmm. not that we're going to forget it, absolutely not, but we work with the stress regulation system. And when we've worked with the stress regulation system of that child and then look back at the behaviour, the issue, the problem, whatever it was, it's slightly different. We look at it in a slightly different way. We manage it in a slightly different way.
Yes, and I suppose responses to challenging behaviour are usually sanctions-based, such as exclusions, but that's not necessarily changing behaviour as such, it's providing feedback on that behaviour.
What it's actually doing is, if we're not careful, it is putting that child into a corner, which is going to make them feel even more challenged. And actually, as Sharon said, you know, when a child feels got at, or that they're not understood, they are literally in a physical state of anxiety. So by talking it through, by having this positive relationship, by having this curiosity, by having this accepting, yes, I accept that you found that difficult. Let's sit down, let's talk it through. You know, let's be curious. Why did that happen? Why did that child do that actual action? Or in the same way, there can be instances where I've seen in the playground where a ball has been thrown at a child. At that moment, when you take that photograph of what has happened, you see something completely different to what actually really happened, what happened before. When you get the whole picture and have a conversation, a level conversation with the child, you go, oh, okay, you did that. I understand. You didn't mean to do it. No, I didn't mean to do it. If you just took a snapshot of what you actually saw, you could come to a completely different conclusion. That these children, as Sharon says, through this Thrive approach of positive relationships, we're building a relationship, we're building a connection with you, we're putting ourselves in your place, and we're going, yeah, actually, you know, when somebody kicked you, you did kick back at them, we understand that is a knee-jerk reaction, but next time let's have a think about doing this way. And they do respond, they take it on board. I see them, they are like sponges. Once you get into this connection and you connect with the children, then they come and have that conversation first. They actually turn it around. I don't have to go and see them, but it's all about them not being put into that corner and feeling threatened, got at. I had one child said, come on then, shout at me. That's what they all do. Let's just get it over with and I won't listen anyway. And we tried this approach, this positive relationship approach, also the PACE approach by Dan Hughes and Kim Golding is very similar. Right, okay. And I saw the child just calm down, and from then on we had a connection, and he came to see me, and his whole demeanor changed, his whole demeanor. And by that we got the building blocks for him being safe, him being regulated. And guess what? The learning began. And he was able to learn because he felt calm and he felt safe.
I think it's quite important, Ginny, with what you're saying also. So it's almost, and I certainly found it very beneficial in the settings that I've led and managed, is looking at the language that we use. And instead of this sort of more punitive language, thinking about, you know, instead of challenging behaviour, maybe this is distress behaviour, and it's to lean in with empathy. And, you know, we talk about PACE in the Thrive approach, and staff are delegates are very much trained with that, and using what we call vital relational functions to a way of being with children. Because what we're endeavouring to do through that relationship that Jenny has just given some fabulous examples of what the impact that this has had with children, is that we create that sense of safety to support them to change a habit. If you've ever had a bad habit, and I'm sure that you haven't, but I have various bad habits. It's very, very difficult to change them. Very difficult. You need, and for children in particular, an adult alongside to repeatedly practice and rehearse the different response. This is why you think of the army, the Marines, what all of their training initially is to change their stress regulation system, their autonomic, automatic response when there's a potential situation of danger. Well, we're kind of doing something similar in a very nurturing way with children. We're supporting that instead of just whisking that tray of oranges out of the hands of the teacher, that's not problem solving. That is not going to help me to get on in life in a way and go on to be okay, to be happy, to achieve. So actually, if I get that trigger to sense it, to be able to name it, understand it a little bit, and potentially tame it and have strategies to manage, that's what this is all about. So we talk about shining the light on the behavior. It's an absolute approach to support children to develop more problem-solving behaviors. And certainly having used this whole school to support sort of right time development, and then through the assessment tool with Thrive, which is really useful to identify when potential interruptions happened for whatever reason. For example, mine, I've already shared to you, it's not with judgment necessarily, safeguarding hat, but not stuff happens in life that makes massive, massive impact. So if we can identify as a result of looking at the topology almost, the behaviours, knowing that they're communicating something else, and then almost assess and look into so that we can identify what that need is. And then we can respond to by creating action plans, interventions, but also whole school approaches to support where children have had those interruptions. And the outcomes, certainly what was interesting in the school that I took over, it was one of the largest excluding schools in the authority, incredible challenging behaviour, not just of the children, I must say, the staff too, but actually settling and giving time and space to settle and take that relational approach. Not only we didn't exclude for 6 years, we didn't need to.
Wow.
And, you know, not only did, you know, sort of the school was judged to be outstanding, but the academic outcomes absolutely increased dramatically.
Gosh.
Because, of course, children were in a settled place for learning. They were physiologically had a sense of safety, working across the community where parents felt welcomed into the school, a sense of safety, and so therefore developed a more positive relationship themselves with the school, some of which had gone through quite negative experiences previously. And so it was almost, we talk about the Japanese art form, kintsugi. It's almost when a ceramic, which represents sort of going through a bit of a trauma, is broken, instead of throwing it away and saying that trauma impacts and that's the end, actually we can put it back together with molten gold, and this is the art form in Japan that they use, and as a result the ceramic is even more strong, of worth, containing. And so if we work with our children and parents, carers, adults in the staff system, communities, then in actual fact we can really facilitate moving towards a place of better and greater resilience. But we have to invest our time and energy. And as Ginny says, you know, being open and honest ourselves as adults, because we will have gone through difficulties too.
Of course.
So looking after ourselves first isn't selfish.
And on that point, given that we know the pandemic has been an amplifier, restrictions, remote learning and isolation having exacerbated existing concerns, do you anticipate teachers might see a greater incidence of this behavioural issue as schools open more widely next week?
I think we've got to be ready, but we've got to also wait. I think we need to learn from home, and I think we need to listen to homes. There are some great resources, free resources out there that we can use with parents and children to find out actually what have they actually enjoyed about home learning? Mm. What have they found difficult? What are they thinking as individuals they will find challenging? And I actually think from that we'll find out what parents are thinking will be challenges as well. So I think I talk about this radar. I think it's about having our radars on, be ready to communicate with the parents and the children, because I 100% feel that once we get that link with home and school, I think there has to be flexibility. I think certain children may find it difficult to come in full time. Well, let's have that conversation. Let's communicate. Let's be flexible. Let's have that conversation with the parents. We want happy children. So let's do that from where the children come in. And what I think is great is we've got these 2 weeks before Easter. And I think that is a real positive because we can get children settled in as they, as individuals, need to. Then we have the Easter holidays and then we come back in again. So I think we just need to look in on what is happening, maybe from a, because sometimes we can be a little bit entrenched, you know, in education, think, actually, we've got to go down this route. Let's just look at it and see what is happening and then do what every child individually needs.
So check in with those pupils who are returning, but also check in with those who have remained on site, who are deemed vulnerable or whose parents are key workers, as they may be so used to these new systems of lesson delivery that the idea of a traditional classroom now terrifies them, just thinking of all the students who are coming back when they're so used to these smaller bubbles.
Checking in, but also anticipating that there is likely to be an increase of anxiety, not just with children, but with the staff team as well and the wider community. You know, as adults, many of us have found parts of this, if not all of it, really challenging. And yet we've got experience, we've got our reference points, and many of us have got sufficiently robust stress regulation systems. Our children haven't. And you think of a six-year-old, they can't remember what they had for dinner yesterday, let alone what they used to do at school eight months ago. And so let's go in with kindness with candor, but kindness, and anticipate that there is likely to be some distress behaviours here, not just from the children, from the adults too, and lean in with empathy with authority, and curiosity as to why children and adults might be responding in different ways at this time. Thinking about that tweak of language, if this is a distress behaviour, what can we do to get in to support and meet the need, not just address the behaviour? You know, the same children tend to find themselves in seclusion, in exclusion, because we're not tackling what's underneath it. We're just responding to the behaviour. So really going in and with a deep breath, so that as the adults, we're regulated, we're talking with each other to get the lived experience of those across the community, the lived experience, because some of them have some stigma attached to this. For some of our families, it may be that they're not working any longer, and it's the first time that they've had that real. So the lived experience, which takes great sensitivity. And then as a result of that, enables us to come from a place of connection with the children, with the adults, but connection within ourselves, connection to our own thinking, reflection, and problem solving. That can only come from adults who are regulated. And so let's be prepared for distress behaviours, potential dysregulation of children and adults, and plan in for that to give the spaces, the places, and the people who are emotionally available to receive folk coming back at this time.
And of course, the situation students are returning to is not normal. Even if they are familiar with some aspects of it from last time, could those aspects be triggering? For example, compulsory frequent testing, the wearing of masks, an allocated desk for the whole day if it's not their usual desk. Could this trigger the flight response in some children?
I think it could. When I'm thinking of my experiences, I think it's very important once again to communicate with parents, some social stories, and for parents to talk it through with children at home. As you said about the use of masks, if children are going to be in a different environment, at a different desk, sending photographs home to those children, all of this gives them a better picture of what they are coming into, because we all don't like change. Change is difficult. Children found it quite difficult in June coming in to a different environment. And I think we've learned from that as well. So I think the more that we can involve children, involve parents, and let them know. Once again, it comes back to communication. Communicate what is happening. Communicate more than we actually think that we need to. Even things like children get worried if their school shoes have got too small. So we need to make parents aware, actually, is it okay for children to come in and train us? You know, we need to make parents aware so that they're not anxious, so that the children aren't anxious. So when they come in that first day, their shoulders are down and they know as much as they can before they come through the door.
And what challenges do the COVID safety rules around social distancing and keeping to bubble throw up for teachers as they try to handle a situation where a pupil tries to leave the classroom? Do you think it makes it even more difficult to handle the situation and even more important that they have the tools to de-escalate this kind of situation and support the pupil to recalibrate and re-engage with learning?
I think once again we have experienced this previously with the previous lockdown, and I think teachers have got so many skills and tools now, more than they've ever had, because they have experienced this. So we've explained to children why they can't go to certain areas in the school. So I think compared to previous lockdown, we are in a better situation, but we are getting to a point where children can go out and get fresh air. If we have got that ability for them to go out. So I think teachers need to look outside of their normal lens and actually go, actually, yes, let's do this instead if we can. But yes, we have got those rules, those barriers. But as teachers, I'm going to say we are pretty resourceful. We do find ways to accommodate things. And we ask people, you know, I'd say, do you know what? Can anyone help me? Get somebody else to have a look with a different lens. Ginny, have you thought about, you know, the cloakroom? That could be a safe place. Oh, yeah, that's all right. Have you thought about going outside with this child and them having some ball games, whatever? So I think we need to see it as a different opportunity.
And Sharon, what's your take on it?
I think we do the best that we can in the situation with the best interests of the child in mind with whom we're supporting. And yet, these are challenging times. I am supporting a number of special schools, residential schools, children's homes for children with who have experienced significant social, emotional, mental health difficulties. And sometimes, you know, those adults need to put a really calming hand on their shoulder, so physiologically supporting in terms of regulation. Actually not to do that could potentially be more dangerous for the child. And so, of course, schools will have their policies, but I would hope that they're really sensible policies, knowing that we're here to support these children through a very, very difficult time. And it's highly likely that some of these our youngsters will need that co-regulation and support. Yes, it's tricky, but let's tackle it with kindness, with candor, and sensible, you know, be really sensible about this. And again, I go back to staff being self-aware in those moments, self-aware, so that we can plan for, preempt and prevent wherever possible. As Ginny has said, we practice with the children again and again and again, because repeated experience is what will support these children, and repeated positive experience. So when things get a little bit tough, if they've rehearsed it, practiced it again and again and again, it's more likely that they'll be able to take that path that they've been supported and rehearsed. You know, and yes, there will be challenging times. I'm absolutely certain you're aware that my other role is as a member of the Youth Justice Board and supporting education in custody and developing the first secure school. Some of our children have experienced significant trauma and absolutely need that kind of connection and regulation. Thinking about that in terms of staff in school settings, how can we almost scaffold and support into Reconnect one step at a time, starting with finding out what the lived experiences are, starting with ensuring that we're looking after our staff, our educational staff. What a phenomenal job. Our teachers by teachers, I'm saying all staff in education have done throughout this pandemic. My goodness, they should be wearing their pants on the outside. Incredible, absolutely incredible. So acknowledge that and let's look after them. Let's keep them well so that they can be emotionally present for the children. Predictable, routines, all of those things which are going to be crucial at this time as we all reconnect back into a sense of safety within that containment of structure. I think looking after each other, absolutely key.
And to finish, it's worth going back to the point you initially made, that this isn't an issue that can't be remedied over time, that we can support adaptive learning.
It's incredible. Our brains are neuroplastic and they are shaped by the experiences and the relationships. So actually, you know, this is real hope and optimism because of the science. We now know that. And so whatever we do, the experiences we facilitate and the relationships that we enable will have a significant impact on our children, on ourselves, on the wider community. So let's take a breath, a deep breath, and exhale, and really come from a place of regulation as we're planning these experiences and how the adults are going to be, i.e. the relationships. So the impact on the children is one of significant positivity, because it comes from a really well thought out, reflected, understood place, as opposed from that unconscious potential self-defensive mechanism that is easy to be triggered at times of challenge.
And I think the idea of team, isn't it, Sharon? The team is the school, it's everybody in the school, everybody who is within the school, and also going to the parents. It's about the children at the centre, and I call it the blanket of care. Let's have this blanket of care for these children around us. Let's all have that connection and all of us working together. And then the children get that continuity. They get that feeling that they are safe with everybody because there is that consistency.
This is all about learning. This isn't a wishy-washy sort of approach. Mm. What we're endeavouring to do is to calm everybody so that we can reignite that absolute flame and desire of awe, wonder and curiosity, and for folk to be in a safe place, not just to engage in the moment, but to retain that learning and take it into long-term memory. Crucial to come from that regulation. But we know the key that unlocks the door to learning is positive human interaction. And Ginny, you were saying being able to feel safe with other people is the single most important aspect of mental health. So safe connections are fundamental to meaningful and satisfying lives. So investing in this way, in this really sort of preemptive, preventative type approach, will without doubt enable our children to go on to flourish and thrive. It's having the courage to sit with this approach and not rush back into something that potentially could be triggering. And then through discharge behaviours mean that children don't engage with learning and adults find it tricky to engage and support.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you both. The importance of this is difficult to overstate, and today you've each provided some really interesting strategies for how teachers can prepare themselves for when a pupil becomes dysregulated and support them to remain in the classroom. Thank you very much for your time.
An absolute pleasure.